Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, February 16th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, we visit Baum Stadium during the opening weekend of Razorback baseball, but not for the game, rather to see how the stadium came to be.
Plus, three things to keep in mind when taking in a theatrical show and the history of Cubans in Fort Smith.
But first, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has a look back at the week's top news stories in this morning's Week in Review.
The state legislature convened Monday for the month-long biennial fiscal session. Going into the session, the topic on most people's minds was the fate of the state's private option, which so far has provided insurance to more than 100,000 low-income Arkansas residents. Democratic Senator David Johnson of Little Rock expressed many legislators' prevailing uncertainty.
It's a bit of a mystery right now, and I think... that things will turn out with the private option like they did last year. But at this point, I'm like Senator Lamoureux, who said recently that he's not exactly sure how it happens, and I am too. But I think in the end it will happen.
Meanwhile, Republican Senator Bart Hester, who voted against the program last year, said the small group of conservative legislators who remain opposed will force a change.
Well, I think on a straight up and down yes-no vote, there is not the votes to fund the private option. It will be defunded. So I think what's going to have to happen here is there's going to have to be some sort of a compromise, maybe a delayed defund, maybe a slow unwind, or maybe some other sort of compromise. There will have to be some sort of compromise to find the funding for the private option.
Lawmakers on Tuesday continued to plan possible changes to the private option to make it more palatable to many of the state's conservatives. While House and Senate leaders said the health insurance program for low-income Arkansans would be reauthorized by the end of the session, House Majority Leader Bruce Westerman told reporters Monday that he didn't see that happening.
From the conversations that I've had, I believe there are votes there to not pass the appropriation when it first comes out, and that we'll have to work on some kind of compromise, but I don't think the compromise will be on how to make the private option better, to change the private option, but a compromise on how we end the private option, setting a date and a pathway to do a controlled wind down of the private option.
Nonetheless, the first concrete proposals to alter the funding of the private option were heard Wednesday in the state capitol. In a packed joint budget subcommittee meeting, legislators were presented with alternative plans to either apply tweaks to the health insurance program for low-income people or to gradually defund it altogether. Republican State Representative Nate Bell of MENA acknowledged the political divisions regarding the program. Bell presented a plan to bar the state from funding promotional efforts to get people enrolled in the program, which he said was a compromise.
The votes are almost certainly there to not pass the private option. The votes are almost certainly not there to pass a budget bill without the private option. That's an impasse, folks. Do we want to become D.C.?
A proposal presented by Republican Representative John Burris would seek waivers from the federal government on the requirement to provide non-emergency transportation to participants. And the Joint Budget Committee considered proposed changes to the plan Thursday. The committee approved the new language in the program's fiscal bill. It involved the state seeking federal approval for establishing health savings accounts, increasing the number of adults who must share health costs, and tweaking how much non-emergency transportation would be provided to people enrolled in the private option. At the meeting, State Representative Burris said there would be a hard deadline for attaining approval.
You could consider we will have input beginning in August, and then a final submission in September, and then again, if there's no approval by December, according to all of the terms and conditions in law, the drawdown begins with an absolute cutoff date of February 1st.
Burris said he was confident the federal government would support the plans, but said the private option would end if they weren't approved. While questioning Burris, State Representative Hank Wilkins explored the possibility of Arkansas not getting the federal waivers, leaving the legislature with a big problem.
Don't you think that a March 1 date would be better than a February 1 date?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on your perspective.
In terms of the legislature having time to really address the issue, I mean, okay. You know, 2 weeks.
Yeah. Now, I think the, you know, my intent of this, and I think the legislature's intent, was to create a situation where there was an incentive for the federal government to agree with us.
The Joint Budget Committee also gave approval for State Representative Nate Bell's plan to block funding for efforts to promote and advertise the private option and federal health insurance marketplace in Arkansas. The appropriations bill for the Department of Human Services, which includes the private option funding, won't be voted on in the House until Tuesday. And the proposed amendments to Arkansas's private option were largely aimed at garnering more support for the legislation, which has lost key supporters in recent weeks. Speaking after an event in North Little Rock and after the amendments passed out of committee Thursday, Governor Beebe was optimistic.
Anytime you got to get 75%, it's, you know, it's a high bar. But we did it before, and we'll struggle and fight and claw and persuade to do it again.
While the governor said he didn't find the amendments ideal, he says it is important to be willing to compromise with others. At this time, garnering support in the Senate poses the biggest hurdle for reaching the 3/4 vote needed to reauthorize funding for the private option. Just 9 senators can override the will of the other 26 members. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
In 1980, more than 125,000 Cubans fleeing Fidel Castro's communist regime were boat-lifted to America and processed at military compounds, including Fort Chaffee in Arkansas. Among the population were thousands of gay Cubans, as well as prisoners that Castro had purged from his jails, any number of them political prisoners. The refugees were widely portrayed by the press as criminals and deviants, a stigma that's persisted. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, historians are working to clarify the record.
Historic Fort Chaffee stands deserted this morning as director Joseph Chastain leads us into some empty, dusty barracks. This massive U.S. military training base has served other critical purposes as a German prisoner of war camp during World War II, a sanctuary for Vietnamese fleeing the fall of Saigon in 1975, and in the summer of 1980, a refuge for Cuban expatriates.
At one time, this was almost 20,000 Cubans were here. You know, accommodating so many people at once was, you know, had to be pretty tough.
Initially, President Jimmy Carter expected only a few thousand Cubans, but a massive flotilla of private U.S. ships and boats brought tens of thousands more men, women, and children from Muriel Port to South Florida. Most were working class, escaping Cuba's deep economic depression. But out of spite, Fidel Castro also opened his jails and referred to all those fleeing as escoria, trash. Archival NBC News tape describing the scene.
There are reports that one of the boats arriving today carried 600 refugees, 400 of them convicts and mental patients.
Some reports counted a few thousand criminals among the refugees, others more than 40,000. It's not clear how many were jailed political dissidents. The U.S. State Department mobilized a multi-agency task force to process incoming Cubans. The Defense Department, FEMA, INS, FBI, U.S. Health and Human Services, along with the U.S. Marshals and State Police, at military compounds in Wisconsin, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Arkansas. The first plane loads of Cubans came to Fort Chaffee May 9th, most of them single men. Within weeks, 20,000 were crowding the compound. Then Governor Bill Clinton had only been given 2 days' notice. Cuban refugee resettlement operation documents detail life inside the camp. Immigrants received I-94s and ID cards, medical screenings, clothing and provisions, and assigned accommodations. Joseph Chastain takes us inside the Museum of Chaffee History to a corner holding a few artifacts and photos from the era.
Fort Chaffee was set up in a matter of days or weeks to handle all of this. There was 50 hospital buildings, active to receive these medical conditions that were coming in, as well as the families who needed immediate housing.
Cubans occupied 600 barracks divided by sex, age, and family status. Suspected and known criminals were separated out. At least two barracks accommodated homosexuals who had also fled Cuba. Barracks leaders were chosen to communicate concerns with task force coordinators. Some Cubans hired on at the camp, and many volunteered. Recreation was provided. English classes were taught. But Cubans here, as well as in other camps, weren't free to leave.
There was over 6 miles of barricades and chain link fence erected during the process of getting ready for them to arrive.
Cuban-American families arriving to take relatives home were initially barred from doing so. The processing of the Cubans was a prolonged and intensive procedure. And because the refugees were increasingly portrayed by the media as villains and deviants, fewer and fewer American sponsors stepped forward to help.
Fort Smith, Barling, and surrounding communities, of course, were hearing all of the hysterical news reports about the criminals coming. There were protests, you know, telling Jimmy Carter to send them back home to Cuba. The Ku Klux Klan showed up for a demonstration at one point.
Frustrated Cubans began to stage demonstrations, culminating in violence June 1st, setting a half dozen barracks ablaze and storming the main gate. The Arkansas State Police intervened.
There were 67 people injured. Reportedly, there was no fatalities.
Governor Clinton deployed 3,000 additional troops to contain the situation. Protests also broke out at other camps, but it would take a year and a half before most of Fort Chaffee's refugees were resettled or returned to Cuba. According to government documents, only 203 Cubans chose to stay in Arkansas, 95 in Fort Smith, 8 in Fayetteville, 15 in Little Rock.
There are not very many of those still around, however.
And Billy Higgins is not surprised. He's an associate professor of history at UA Fort Smith, which provides coursework on the Cuban boat lift.
Their reception at Chaffee was sort of guarded, maybe even borderline hostile. They had several influential politicians through the time visit here to try to take up the, I guess, to reconcile those who were running the relocation and the Cubans. The food, the surroundings, it was a lot different than 6 or 7 years prior to that when the Vietnamese were here.
50,000 Vietnamese refugees fleeing the fall of Saigon in 1975 were quickly processed through Fort Chaffee. By comparison, Higgins says, and more than 2,000 Vietnamese live in Fort Smith today. One Cuban man, now in his 60s, who lives a half hour west of Fort Chaffee, declined being interviewed for this report.
And the Cubans were, I think most of them thought they were indefinite detainees. And the cultural sensitivity to them was not very high in this area.
Cuban agitators at Fort Chaffee were arrested, of course, and tried in locally staged federal courts of law.
I'm Jim Spears. I'm a circuit judge in the 12th Judicial District.
Seated in his office in downtown Fort Smith, Judge Jim Spears says the entire city was taken off guard by the Cubans' arrival. But he says the Cubans were equally confused by their strict containment.
Out here, they don't know why they're in this place that they're in. And whatever happened, they start rushing toward the gates, and they're going to leave. And the Army would not do anything, because they didn't think they had the authority to do anything to stop these people. They weren't prisoners.
Jim Spears had just opened his law practice and had no intention of getting involved with the mess at Fort Chaffee. But when he learned that the U.S. federal courts were looking to hire a federal public defender to represent Fort Chaffee Cubans for crimes committed at the compound, he saw an opportunity.
And so I applied for it and interviewed and was selected.
As public defender, Jim Spears spent months in the camp, meeting with Cubans from all walks of life.
I moved with ease throughout the compound. I had my little tag on. I had two interpreters that went with me, my investigators / interpreters. They would be sitting on the stoop. Kids would be playing in the street. It was like you were in a South American country. So you had a cross-section of folks. Some were really good folks. Those are the ones we moved out into the community around the country.
Jim Spear says Arkansans were distressed by the Cubans and wanted them gone. And
they blamed President Carter. They blamed Governor Clinton. To bring all these Cubans in here. It's a terrible thing to do. And here's Castro emptying his jails. These are all a bunch of really, really bad, bad people. And that wasn't true. There were some. There are some really bad, bad people out there. But that was the view of the population. It was not mine after having been out there. And I was really terribly sorry to see them leave because I had a really good job.
Perla Guerrero wrote her PhD dissertation on Fort Chaffee's Cuban refugees, which she's turning into a book. She's an assistant professor at University of Maryland College Park. She writes that the Cubans were portrayed as a threatening triumvirate, criminal homosexual communists.
So the media really bought into Castro's own discourse of who he was sending. And the reports of criminality are also based on the fact that there were a lot of people that had been in Cuban jails. But what was not really reported was that a lot of the people had been in jail for selling on the black market or for their own anti-communist activities on the island. And so while they did have a criminal record, they weren't, the vast majority of Cubans in 1980 were not violent criminals.
And a relatively large number of Cuban refugees were gay. Fidel Castro denounced homosexuality in the late 60s as a threat to the revolution, leading to intense discrimination and tens of thousands of gay Cubans being forced into labor camps. By 1980, the situation had eased, but intense prejudice persisted, with any number of gay Cubans jailed as political dissidents.
In Cuba, being gay was not acceptable. You really had to be in the closet. You really had to hide your sexual orientation. And if people suspected that you were gay, you were denied positions as teachers or other kind of jobs that dealt with society.
On the U.S. side, while the battle for gay civil rights was well underway, federal authorities still barred openly gay immigrants' entry. But during the 1980s purge, Guerrero said, Castro did let gay Cubans secure a special deportation card.
That allowed you to leave the island. You had gay men play up their homosexuality, and you also had straight men that pretended that they were gay in order to get this letter, in order to leave the island. So this perpetuated the myth that everybody that was leaving was gay.
And the presence of thousands of gay Cubans posed a unique problem for U.S. INS officials.
1980 is a very crucial moment in the United States-Cuban relations. On the one hand, the United States wanted to continue its so-called open-door policy for Cubans that were fleeing a communist country. And on the other hand, this group of Cubans was vastly different than the prior waves that they had dealt with. And so there was a lot of miscommunication and a lot of just playing it by ear to determine which way people were sent.
In the new book, Oye Loca, author Susan Pena describes how American gay activists came forward to help assimilate gay Cuban boat lift refugees, who she says numbered over 3,000, eventually settling in places like Miami, New York, and San Francisco. Now, out of the 125,000 refugees that came to America, only 2,700 were denied U.S. citizenship and deported back to Cuba. Perla Guerrero and other scholars believe the Cuban unrest at Fort Chaffee needs to be reframed.
I think thinking of it as a protest is absolutely the correct way to think about it. You know, they arrived and they didn't see people exiting. And a lot of Cubans already had family members in the United States. They had connections. They had jobs waiting. They had families they wanted to see. And they were not being allowed to leave the camp.
Detained by a stigma fanned by relentless negative media reports, she says, that all Fort Chaffee Cuban refugees were forced to endure. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Later today on This American Life.
It was about 6 o'clock in the morning, woken by knocking at the door. Consistent knocking, you know, the hard knocking. So I knew something.
He was a small business owner, had a young family, coached his kids' football team, church going.
They had AR-15 style machine-looking guns.
The regular guy.
I said, hey, man, you got the wrong person.
Except for one thing.
He said, no, you're the right person.
It's later today.
It begins this morning at 10 on 91.3 FM.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Arkansas Razorback baseball began this weekend with a three-game series against Appalachian State. The third game in that series begins this afternoon at 1:05 p.m. inside Baum Stadium at George Cole Field. Since its opening in 1996, Baum Stadium has received much national recognition. Most recently, this past January, when Baum Stadium was recognized as Stadium Journey's 37th best stadium experience in the United States or Canada. Keep in mind that the top five on that list are Daytona International Speedway and Fenway Park. Also by Stadium Journey, Baum Stadium was recognized as the number three collegiate baseball experience. When I heard that news in January, I kind of wondered where the name Baum Stadium came from. So in this month's What's in a Name series, I decided to look at it. I found out that the stadium is named after Charles Baum. He was one of the major players in the growth of Walmart. Baum passed away in 1992, but his daughter, Sally Frick of Fort Smith, is still alive and says he got his start in business with a different retailer.
He was the superintendent of Ben Franklin Stores. He would set up these stores, put them in, get merchandise in, and get them all set up. And that's how he met Sam Walton, because Sam had a Ben Franklin store.
Sally's husband, Elvin Frick.
We've got a picture here in our library of Sam Walton and his brother and Willard and Charlie at one of those stores when they opened it. So they were all very close. And if you read his book, Made in America, Sam Walton's book, Charlie's mentioned in that book.
That would be Rob Walton and Willard Walker. Growing up in St. Louis, Sally remembers watching the Cardinals, and to this day prefers baseball to other sports. Sally's great-grandparents were from Baden-Baden, Germany, the name Baum meaning tree in German.
That's kind of an unusual name. When I was going to school, I was teased a lot and about the name of Baum. And I said, I never thought I would. It would turn out that I would be ever so proud of it.
Though she hasn't been to Fayetteville in years, Sally will cut out any newspaper clippings about Baum Stadium and her father to send to remaining family in St. Louis. To find out how Baum Stadium came to be Baum Stadium, I got with Norm DeBryan, baseball coach at the University of Arkansas for 33 years, from 1970 to 2002. Coach DeBryan was contacted by the American Legion in the early 90s. The American Legion are longtime supporters of youth baseball. They needed funding to fix the lights at one of their fields. The Legion knew that DeBryan went to church with Mr. Baum and requested that he make the initial contact. Coach DeBryan obliged, but said he found that first phone call left him somewhat embarrassed.
So I call him, and I said, is this Charles Baum? Yes. I said, well, I'm Norm DeBryan, baseball coach. I said, do you usher at the 11:30 Mass? Because I had heard that. I did a little research, and he said, yes. And I said, okay. I says, American Legion program is wanting some money for their lighting project or would like some help, and we know that you've been connected with Little League Baseball in the past. Boy, he hardly said anything. I'll never forget it. I get off the phone, and I'm thinking to myself, why didn't I make an appointment with him? Why didn't I go to him? I didn't do the right thing. So I just go on about my business.
A few weeks later, the American Legion commander called Coach DeBryan to thank him, but he didn't know what for. As it turns out, Baum had given the American Legion the $10,000 it needed for youth baseball.
That was that, so I call him again. I said, Charlie, this is Norm DeBryan. I had talked to you earlier. Thank you so much for what you did for American Legion Baseball. I said, do you ever drink coffee? He said, yes, we have a coffee clutch. Yada, yada. He made it easy.
That cup of coffee led to a short but rich friendship. It was around 1991, and the University of Arkansas was about to join the Southeastern Conference. The baseball field was where the football practice fields currently are. While a step up from playing at the fairgrounds like they had in the past, George Cole Field was in need of renovation.
George Cole Field was nice in its day, but the AstroTurf was on there so long that the pad disintegrated between the AstroTurf and the asphalt. And so I remember in the Southwest Conference, Texas coming in here, and Cliff Gustafson, the Texas coach, telling me, Norm, we can't play on this. I mean, it's too dangerous. It's like playing on cement, and I mean, going to kill our third baseman or whatever. And so we were trying to upgrade, but we didn't have the money, didn't have the budget, and things like that.
At that first cup of coffee, Baum asked O'Brien what he planned to do with the facilities now that he was in the SEC. Baum committed to giving $250,000 to the renovations of George Cole Field. Soon after, he committed another $250,000 to the project. At the time, efforts were also underway for the construction of Bud Walton Arena, the Razorbacks basketball stadium. Then athletic director Frank Broyles and basketball coach Nolan Richardson approached Baum to contribute to that project. And Baum told them,
I don't have money for the basketball facility, but I'll give $500,000 to the baseball facility. And that made it $1 million straight up.
Coach DeBrien and his family formed a quick bond with Baum and his wife Nadine, the coach bringing his young daughter to play Uno with Baum as his health declined. He did not survive long after the $1 million commitment, passing away in June of 1992. Baseball fans wanted to see the renovations completed, but Coach Broyles said that they still needed more money. Close friend of Baum's, Willard Walker, whose son Johnny Mike played baseball for Arkansas in the 1970s, committed another $1 million to the project, but the Walkers wanted it named in Baum's honor. With funding in place, Frank Broyles had the vision that a new stadium should be constructed. And in 1996, a midseason doubleheader against Auburn were the first games played in Baum Stadium at George Cole Field.
Baum Stadium is a state-of-the-art. Frank Broyles had a tremendous vision, talking about walking in on a concourse level and looking down on the field. So every seat would be a good seat. There would be no cross aisles and no type thing where you're standing in front of somebody. You know, I mean, that was a tremendous concept. And then big concourse, you know, where the concourse is here and the concessions are here, so you can buy a Coke or a hot dog and still you can be on the concourse. You're not obstructing anybody. The people are down here looking at the field.
The University of Arkansas kept the name of the field after the former coach and athletic director, George Cole. They also kept some of the lights from the original location. They're still illuminating the field. 2 years after those first wins, Baum Stadium was named the number one college baseball facility in the nation by Baseball America.
Only regret would be that Charlie didn't see the fruition of everything. Maybe he has, you know.
Baum gave not only to university baseball, but also to basketball and other various youth sports. According to his daughter, Sally Frick, he loved children, always setting up a train set in store windows at Christmas for their amusement. As such, Arkansas Children's Hospital was also on Baum's list of charities. Residents of the area may recognize his late wife's name, Nadine, from the Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios. It's the location for Theater Squared and the Community Creative Center. Married to Charles late in life, Nadine was not Sally's mother, but Sally still remembers Nadine as a very artistic person.
She could see an outfit, a dress or a coat or something, and she'd go home and make it. Didn't even have a pattern. But she was just very artistic, and she was so good at it. Had a lovely home, and she was just a lovely person. So I'm glad to know that her art center is still there. I wish you could see these pillows that she made for me on my sofa in the living room. They are gorgeous. And she made them by hand. She was very artistic and very just a loving person.
Sally Frick is Charles Baum's daughter and was thrilled to talk to me about her father. Proud to hear his name. For a complete schedule, visit ArkansasRazorbacks.com.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Time now for a montage?
Yes, it's our Sunday morning montage. Though Valentine's Day was Friday, it's still Valentine's Day weekend.
Absolutely. I think anytime you have a holiday on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, you can kind of extend it through the weekend, which I'm a big fan of extending holidays.
You are. Birthdays, things like
birthdays
that.
Birthdays and things like that, of course.
Right. Well, so Kyle put together sort of a Valentine's-themed montage for us this morning. It is bows and arrows.
Oh.
Because Cupid, you know, he has
bows and arrows.
Right.
Creative.
Mm-hmm. All right. So see how you can do on Cupid's bow and arrow montage.
Shooting for my own hand.
What are you doing?
Merida!
Curse this dress!
Merida, stop this! Don't you dare loose another arrow!
Me and my arrow, straighter than arrow.
What is your name, Archer?
Godfrey of Sherwood, Your Highness.
How is it that a tinker learns so well the use of arms?
Even a peaceful tinker must protect himself these days, Your Highness. Treachery and other unpleasant things.
It's earned you more than you bargained for today.
Keep your elbow high. You want your back doing the hard labor. You're holding. Never hold.
What?
Your muscles tense up when you hold. Pull the string back to the center of your chin and release. Never hold.
But I have to aim.
Never aim.
Never aim.
Your eye knows where it wants the arrow to go.
Kiss lots of boys, but kiss lots of girls. If that's something you're into, straight and narrow gets a little too straight.
Nice shooting, sweetheart. What did they do when you shot the apple?
Well, they looked pretty startled.
To see how you did on our Sunday morning Cupid montage, go to ozarksatlarge.com.
In the early 20th century, moviegoers would often see announcements on the screen about proper etiquette for the theater. These images would include phrases like, "Ladies, kindly remove your hats," or, "If annoyed when here, please tell the management." When being a part of the audience for the performing arts, the guidelines for proper behavior has changed over the years, and that has left modern-day audiences questioning how to react to the performers on stage. For example, audiences may have found themselves wondering when the appropriate time to clap is. In the latest installment of our monthly Three Things You Should Know series, we decided to find out three things we should know about theater etiquette. We enlisted the help of Beth Bobbitt, Public Relations Director for Walton Arts Center, who stopped by Studio 123 earlier this week. She says the first topic we need to address is children and the theater.
The question I get asked all the time is, what show or is this show appropriate for my child? And of course, there's no hard and fast rule for what is appropriate. But a couple things to keep in mind. We don't have a rating system. Mm-hmm. So we really try and provide all the content, you know, on the website or on the blog or on our Facebook page to let parents know exactly what's going to be in it. So will there be violence? Will there be language? And of course, we do have shows that are specifically for kids and families. And when that's the case, you know, we'll make sure and tell you that up front. We have a policy. So if it is appropriate for kids and family, the policy is that you can bring your children under two and they can sit on your lap and they don't need a ticket. And for all non-infant friendly shows, you do have to pay for even babies. So that's just a general rule of thumb.
Well, for the non-infant specific shows, the ones that aren't really geared towards kids, would you suggest more that people leave their children at home?
Well, I personally wouldn't. You know, I went to the theater when I was really young, when I was 5 or 6 years old. And I think that that sort of, you know, shaped my life and made me appreciate arts and culture and all of those wonderful things. So it could be a really magical experience if it's done well. On the flip side, it could be really, you know, kind of a disaster if a child isn't prepared, and because they're used to watching television, you know, or they're used to interacting with people. They don't understand that you have to sit quietly and watch the show unless they're explained these things. And so I think it's just all about, you know, preparing your kids and making sure they're mature enough for what they're about to see. And one series that I think is really good for older kids is our 10 by 10 series. And I say that because it's kind of an introduction to some of these fine arts, you know, dance, theater, jazz, and the shows are just $10. So if you find that your child isn't connecting or isn't responding well, you can leave it intermission and you've only lost $10. So,
no harm in trying.
Yeah, something to think about.
What's the next thing we should know about theater etiquette?
The next thing, courtesies. These are just sort of fun tips that a lot of people don't think about. Someone told me recently that the Walton Arts Center Theater is a little bit different in that we don't have a center aisle. So when you have to excuse yourself for whatever reason, you have to kind of
crawl over people.
And that can be annoying to some people. And so one thing that you can do to make it a little bit less inconvenient is to just face the people so that you can say, excuse me, or smile, or just acknowledge, you know, that you're asking them to move. And so that's just a really small thing. Another thing is to wait for the cue at the end, the curtain call. And I think this is just more respectful for the artists and performers because that's their time to get the reward from the performance, you know. And that's their time to look out into the audience and connect and see how, you know, you as an audience member are responding to the show. And so it's just a really important thing to make sure and build that time in and know that, you know, you may have a little delay afterwards because of whatever reason, but that's part of the show.
And you talk about rewarding them for what they've done. That's something that I've had a question about. I know I've gone to shows and say if it's a Broadway musical, once they finish a number, there's often applause, and that's okay, right?
Right. Yes, that's actually my next one is clapping, just or just audience response in general. And I'd say with Broadway shows, yeah, between scenes or between acts, it's totally appropriate to clap and let them know that you liked it. Where the area gets a little bit gray is with symphonies. So, of course, you've probably heard that, you know, sort of the traditional way of thinking is that you wait until you don't clap in between movements. You wait until the composition is over. I think those rules are relaxing a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give your listeners too specific of information regarding how they should respond.
Sure, sure.
But just know that it sort of depends on the conductor. It sort of depends on the format. And if you're like me and aren't sure, just kind of wait for your cue and see what your neighbors are doing. But it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be inspiring. And we want people to try new things. And we want this to be an approachable art form. So don't worry too much about the rules.
What about, I wondered this too, what about like dancing? I saw Company Cuffy, you know, a few weeks ago, and in between a specific act, you know, somebody may do a fantastic aerial thing and somebody would start giving applause. I'm like, can I do that?
I would say for dance, it's yes, you absolutely can. I think for a lot of people, they're so in awe that they forget to applaud. And, you know, and so it might feel a little awkward, but I don't think the performers mind it a bit. So I think that's totally appropriate.
Okay, good to know. So I can
and of course, yes, yes. And of course, contemporary, you know, music, hooping and hollering is totally encouraged as well. I mean, you know, we want people to respond when they're feeling joy and excitement, and it's all part of the theater experience.
And I think maybe you bring up a good point that, you know, you mentioned the roles are relaxing. I think maybe that's where some people aren't quite sure what to do because maybe their grandparents took them to theater and it was very specific, you know, very proper, very, you know, very much more poised, and now things are starting to relax. For example, you know, people used to always dress up to go to the theater, and that's not necessarily a requirement. You can.
Right. Good point. Yes. And there's no dress code, of course. People do tend to dress up a little bit more for the symphony and for Broadway shows. But in general, you know, we want people to be comfortable. We want people to feel like they're sitting at home and just focused on the show and not worried about how they should act or what they should wear.
And what's the third thing they should
know? The third thing is just general policies. And these are things that most people do know. For instance, put your cell phones away. Most shows do not allow pictures or or recording, but occasionally they do. And so we will let you know in the curtain speech usually what the rules are. Latecomers, we, you know, attempt to begin all performances on time, and sometimes the companies have really specific rules. If people show up late, we have to escort them in after the first act. So just know that and be aware and make sure you allow enough time. And then the last thing I wanted to mention, because it's on people's minds, is inclement weather policy. We've actually never really had one in the past. Our exchange policy is just generally you have to let us know 24 hours. If something comes up and you can't make a show, we want to try and get you into another show. But with this winter being what it was, we had to really take a look at that policy. And so we are a little bit more flexible. We understand that if winter weather arises the day of and it's impossible for you to get to the theater, we want to make sure that we can get you into another show if that's possible, if our contracts or or the artists allow that. So we've loosened up that exchange policy a little bit, and we have a great box office staff. So if you're ever in question, just feel free to call and ask. Those are basically it. I would just say in general, remember that you're in a room full of other people, and again, we want you to be comfortable, but at the same time, courteous, and so hopefully that was helpful.
That was Beth Bobbitt, Public Relations Director for Walton Arts Center. She stopped by KUAF earlier this week. If you want to practice your newfound knowledge about proper theater etiquette at an upcoming performance, you can visit waltonartscenter.org for more information.
Good morning. It is Sunday, February 16th, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Ooh, I get to say I told you so.
Why?
I love that. Because I believe that I mentioned when we were looking ahead to this year that you should make plans to see Les Mis at Rogers Little Theater.
You did.
And it opened Friday night, and apparently it's everything I expected.
It's not over yet, is it?
Oh, no, no, okay. No.
We still have chances to see
it. Oh, yeah.
She just told us, though, on how fabulous it was going to be.
And they are already within, let's see, 130 tickets of their best-selling show ever.
Wow.
Without the show even opening.
That
was reservations. So that's pretty impressive. Ed McClure, who is a crazy man and a great director, had more than 100 people audition way back in December and cast 37 of them. And the whole epic, sweeping, huge musical, wow, has to have strong leads. And one of them is our friend from Gridiron, Justin Stewart.
Yes, very excited that he got a role in this.
Is he playing Jean Valjean?
He is Javert.
Okay.
And Shane Sturdivant is playing Jean Valjean.
Okay.
And then there's the other 35 people, an orchestra of 11.
Have they had an orchestra before?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do for the big musicals.
Okay.
But Ed said he had the privilege of listening to them rehearse without the actors and realized what an absolutely glorious score it was, mm-hmm. which he said a lot of people might not think about. He says it's like another character in the show. And then there's the costumes, all the period props.
Sets.
And sets that fly, roll. And I'm not really sure how they get the barricade. Because, you know, it's not the old days of theater when you could close the curtain. Mm-hmm. RLT doesn't even have a curtain. It's a thrust stage. Mm-hmm. But you can't close the curtain, put on some music, and change the set. So things have to happen really fast. And the barricade appears somehow.
Okay. Might have to
not
go find
really
out how.
Sure how. And then, of course, the cast also brings things on. And he wants to point out that those are the sexy parts. But you should also pay attention to, like, the period costuming and the period props. And and bless their hearts. Bless their hearts. The show runs through March 2nd. And, like I said, it will set a record.
Sure.
For reservations.
Good for them.
You should plan ahead and take note. It's at 2 o'clock today, again next weekend, and again February 27th through March 2nd. They've added downstairs seating. So there's the dinner theater seating, and then they've added platforms for raised seating.
Have they really?
So tickets start at $10 for the balcony and go up to $48 for dinner. Wow. RogersLittleTheater.org. And also this afternoon, the last performance of Bridge to Terabithia at Arts Live Theater at 2 o'clock. Tickets for that are $6 to $8. And Kevin Kinder, our music editor, recommends John Fesner, who is best known as a songwriter, penned songs for Martina McBride, John Mellencamp, Faith Hill, and many more, and earned a Grammy for the Kathy Mattea song, Where Have You Been?
Country.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he opens the 2014 Eureka House Concert Series on Elk Street tonight at 6 o'clock. Starts with a 5 o'clock meet and greet and potluck, and admission is $15. And, oh, you don't want to miss what the boys that I helped raise once called the best movie ever, but in musical form on stage, Bring It On. Nominated for 2 Tony Awards.
I saw it when it was here. It was a lot of fun.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's in Fort Smith this time.
It is, for one show only at 7:30 Monday at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center, and tickets start at $32 by calling 788-7300.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Conductor Bruno Walter once said of Anton Bruckner that his compositions spring from elemental musical creativeness by the boundless emotional resources and exalted visions of his soul. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUIF Sunday Symphony, Sunday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Join me for Bruckner's Fourth Symphony from the Columbia Symphony Orchestra, led by Bruno Walter.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. As we mentioned earlier in the program, we are kind of continuing that theme of Valentine's Day weekend. And earlier this week, I had Shannon Wurst inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. I invited her in to kind of talk about love songs. And while she was here, she played a pair of love songs, including this one.
I have wandered over this countryside. Falling in love feels like a million times, but there is one sure as a sun, steady as rays, true as it do when the day's begun. All the mountains give me strength, all the forest give me peace. So oh, it's you, oh, it's you, river I need. I told the timber I'm tired of falling for you. I told the wolf deep in the night I ain't coming. calling to you. Ooh, every crest, every crooked creek flows from the source straight to the heart of what's truly me.
That was Shannon Wurst inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio earlier this week. You can find out more at shannonwurst.com.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 33rd season of entertainment presents Bring It On, the musical. That's tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. inside the Fort Smith Convention Center. Inspired by the film, this production presents a colorful crew of characters with explosive sound, dance, and aerial stunts. Tickets and more information are available at uafs.edu.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Pea Ridge.
Pea Ridge. Mm-hmm. I've never been to the battlefield there, I don't think.
Have you not?
Mm-mm.
It's been a while. My parents took us mm-hmm. when we were much younger, so it's been a while. I drive by it often,
yeah.
But...
Well, you went to school in Rogers. I grew up in Fayetteville, and so we always went to Prairie Grove Battlefield for field trips.
Oh, sure. Exactly. Right. We would go where was closer, right. I suppose.
Yeah. Because you lived in Rogers. You grew up in Rogers.
I grew up in Rogers. So.
Yeah. Well, it's Sunday. I love Sunday night TV.
Yeah. Sunday's a really nice day to just kind of sit and just prepare for the week. So
it
I
is.
Often find myself like cooking and just kind of watching TV before bed.
For sure. It's so hard to
watch?
Choose. It's hard to choose because there's a lot of good TV on on Sunday nights. There's The Walking Dead,
right,
which came back last week.
Yeah.
There's The Good Wife.
Mm-hmm. I've always heard good things about that one. Mm-hmm. Never caught it, but I've always heard good things.
Downton Abbey.
Another one.
Is one of my favorites, too.
So. Yeah. That's on PBS?
It is on PBS, yeah.
I need to get caught up on all these things. I feel
you
so
do.
Out of the loop.
House of Cards, though.
Yes, House of Cards I did
on
watch.
Netflix.
And I know I have a couple friends who are excited that it is back for sure. And the thing with Netflix is they release the whole season at once. So this weekend it was all available. So
right.
I need to get on that.
Lots of people excited about it, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'll be binge watching that soon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then we can discuss.
Yeah. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
You'll be back tomorrow with an all-new...
I did, an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large, just by myself. And then I'll be back on Tuesday with Kyle Kellums. And then you and I will be back together on Wednesday.
That's right.
At noon for an all-new edition.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for listening and have a good Sunday.
Okay.